Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room?
No.
The billiard?
Not billiards. It was... Come on, everybody. What? Come on. We call it
the place to be.
The place to be, yes.
It's the place to be. Then I shall be there.
WrestleMania 2, but the world has come to.
As the Kenny G-esque saxophone tones bring us into this week's episode here on the Place to Be podcast, Place to Be Nation, welcome aboard. And with me, as always, is my PIC, Scott Criscolo. Scott, how are you doing on this fine Monday evening?
Good evening, Mr. Rosero. Good to hear you, as always.
And also on the line with us is our friend, hopefully sounding much better than last time he was with us, and that's Matt Rotella. Matt, how are you feeling today?
A lot better. I get all those Marlboro Reds.
Okay, good. You sound much, much sexier today than last time. And as I did see you earlier today, you definitely look sexier than last I remembered.
I got my voice back finally.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't sound like you're on the floor of a bar.
Well, that'll be a few months from now. But anyway, so first up, not first up, but what we're
here. Are we doing an actual podcast for that?
You want to do a live podcast of his bachelor party? That could work.
I think we should do a podcast for the bachelor party.
That could definitely work.
That could be really dangerous. I don't want a part of that in any way, shape, or form.
I think it would be high class entertainment.
It would definitely be entertaining, but the ramifications from it would not be good for me.
I think we'll have to make it a special video podcast.
That's even worse.
Oh yes. Little taste of heaven, yes.
All right, that's enough. So let's get going here. Today we're going to do our review of WrestleMania 2. This is going to kick off a pretty big week of podcasts for us. We got a few coming up. And also what we're going to do at the end of the show is hit up some feedback that we've gotten recently in our email and Facebook page. So we'll give you those addresses later and we'll read some of the feedback we've received, which is something we definitely are looking forward to doing. So make sure you get those emails and Facebook posts in so we can go ahead and get that information, you know, read out on air and discuss it. So Scott, I'll let you kick off WrestleMania 2 here for us.
All right. We turn back the clock to April 7th, 1986. Now, here's a little piece of trivia for you younger wrestling fans who may not remember this show or may not have been alive or were really, really young. This is actually the only WrestleMania in WWE history that was not on a Sunday. The show was actually on a Tuesday. It was a Tuesday night. And I remember it because it was actually the first live, pseudo-live, I guess you could say, wrestling event I ever was at. I actually watched this show on closed circuit from my home arena, the old New Haven Coliseum. My dad and I went. And it was actually on a Tuesday. And I've actually, on a side note, considering that WWE probably has some of the best production values and research people in history in terms of getting, you know, putting DVDs together and the like, I've always been pissed off and annoyed that any time they put a match on a DVD or refer to WrestleMania 2, they always get the damn date wrong. It's not April 2nd. It's not April 5th. It was April 7th. I have the program. The date's on it. They're wrong. And that's what happens sometimes when you have researchers that are in their mid-20s who are probably not alive when this show actually was going on.
Oh, we're not all as old as you are. We definitely know that.
Well, you know, exactly. That is true. I was there for Starcade 66. So anyway, but that was the date. So it was April 7th, 1986. Now, obviously the first WrestleMania, huge success for Madison Square Garden.
No, actually I have a question for you here. I was just kind of Google searching this because I know I've read different things. According to Google, April 7th – oh, was it March 7th or April 7th?
April 7th.
April 7th, 86 was a Monday.
So maybe it was a Monday night then.
I just rocked your world, didn't I?
You know what? I really wasn't there, so – no, I'm just kidding. No, let me –
That'd be surprising since you've been on this planet since 1886.
You know what? We are not going to do your bachelor party. We're going to do when you're in prison. So let's see. let me look at the calendar. I got to confirm this now because it's driving me bonkers.
All right, well, you go ahead and do that. We'll talk about the setup here. Basically, for WrestleMania 2, they wanted to build something bigger than WrestleMania 1. So Vince thought the best way to do that was to have the event come from three different locations throughout the night. You know, a lot of people crap on this idea, me included, because it was kind of radical to do on such, you know, a show that really hadn't gained a foothold yet, but it really was no different than what the NWA would do a little bit more successfully with the Great American Bash later on. But I guess the problem here is that they tried to do it all in one night, you know, cutting back and forth through the different arenas. Well, not back and forth, going from one to one to one. So the first part was to take place in the Nassau Coliseum in Uniondale, New York. Attendance there, according to most records, 16,585. And the announcers are Vince McMahon and Susan St. James. And Scott, since you are probably most familiar with Susan St. James because you were the oldest during that time, could you fill us in on who she was?
I absolutely hate both of you right now. Susan St. James was an actress. She was on a popular sitcom in the 80s called Kate and Allie.
Now, I do remember that show. That was a good show.
She was also on a lot of shows in the 70s as well. But she was a well-known actress. Getting to your tri-city idea, I think the problem here was, and we'll see this throughout the rest of wrestling history when it came to Vince. Vince always liked an idea, but instead of like just waiting for it to kind of marinate and maybe grow in his head, he absolutely had to do it right then and there. It's in my head. We have to do it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I don't know if this idea probably ever would have worked. Matt, what do you think? Do you think even in like, I don't want to go too far ahead, but even let's say the Attitude Era, do you think that this idea probably ever would have worked? Three cities at the same time?
I don't think so. It just doesn't work out, especially with the announcing that they had. They had a different announcer for every town they were in, but in each case, the announcing sucked.
Well, yeah. I always thought that the celebrities they picked were not the most stellar. But we'll talk more about them as we go along. But yeah, Susan St. James was a popular actress. She was on Kate and Allie in the '80s. And then she kind of faded from view, I think, after WrestleMania 2. Maybe her performances as an announcer were so bad she couldn't get a job anywhere else. But
well, no, she was married to – was it Dick Ebersol? Is it her that was married to – or is that Kathy Lee Crosby? Which of these two? I know one of them. Let me look it up because I think that was kind of the hook on why one of them – I'm pretty sure it's Susan St. James. Why she was even involved in the show was because she was married to Ebersol.
I actually agree with you. I think she was – she was on McMillan and Wife. She actually went to Connecticut College. She's actually from the state of Connecticut, actually. She's a Connecticut girl, believe it or not. She was married to Dick Ebersol, yes.
Okay.
She actually still is.
Okay. All right. So that makes sense. I think that was a big part of it, because as we know, Vince has a very good relationship with Dick Ebersol. He ran NBC Sports and different, yep. And also did SNL. So he had a lot of pull, and I'm sure that was part of, you know, just a favor from Vince to him, maybe stemming from Saturday Night's Main Event, or, you know, who knows, just trying to get Susan St. James some exposure. So yeah, but she's pretty much an awful debacle during this whole part of the show. And as we go through each match, we'll kind of hit some of her highlights.
Yes. Let us talk about the opener. From the Nassau Coliseum on the New York side. And that was two guys who, at least at this point in time, probably were really in need of something different. The Magnificent Morocco, who was a big-time heel in the early 80s, but he wasn't even at WrestleMania 1.
Odd.
And which was really strange because he was actually hotter then.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets thrown in here, and his opponent is a babyface who kind of fizzled out by the end of 85, beginning of 86, and that was Paul Orndorff. Orndorff was red hot as a face the previous summer, right after Roddy Piper and Cowboy Bob turned on him at the end of WrestleMania 1. And this was the – I didn't mind this as the opener, but why would this match be booked the way it was? I mean, it ended in a double countout. The match itself was just bad.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It just was – I don't know. This kind of started the night off really – poorly, and I think it was a harbinger of things to come. I don't know.
Well, I guess, I mean, you got to figure it kind of stemmed because Morocco was Piper's, Piper's boy, kind of. So I'm guessing at some point in late 85, early 86, Orndorff kind of transitioned to a feud with Morocco coming off the Piper feud. But yeah, I don't get the double count out. I mean, it's not like they're really keeping Morocco strong for anything here. I don't know why they didn't put Orndorff over to, you know, help build him up for what was to come later in the year. It's just kind of a weird way to start off such a major show, but I guess at the time they didn't really look at it that way. But it's a short match, just over 4 minutes, just some basic brawling, and then that's it. They get counted out, and we move on. So that it's just a weird match. Matt, you have anything on that?
I think they just put him in there because they really had no other guys to go to. They had all their guys spread all over the country, and they needed something to go there. So they found these two guys. Let's put these two guys together for a quick match to waste some time, pretty much.
Yeah, and I agree. And it has to go. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Scott.
No, no, I was just gonna say I agree with him on that because I think that the fact that this card is so spread out, and I don't think, and obviously Vince's roster was, I guess, not as good as a lot of people thought it was, because you know, you could have definitely had better guys here, but I think Matt's right. I think just the roster just laid out all over the country. They had to just fill holes, and you know, this was one that was filled poorly.
And I think it's kind of like a little bit like we talked about WrestleMania 1 last time, is that, yeah, they were just kind of not utilizing their talent correctly. Like, and I guess we can just transition to our next match to kind of get that point across with the Randy Savage-George Steele match. I know they had a pretty good feud going on, Steele and the whole Elizabeth thing, but I don't know. I hate this match. I am just not. There are very few wrestlers that I hate, and George Steele is one of the ones I can't stand. I just never liked him. He always bored me. He always aggravated me. I just hated all his stupid stalling, and I just never, ever liked him. So I wish they didn't have him here. I don't know why they didn't do Savage Tito IC title rematch, because as we know, Randy Savage had, we'll get into him in a minute, but he defeated Santana for the title in February. So that would have made sense to do a rematch here, or even have him maybe fight Orndorff, just something. Just use someone else that would have fit better than this disaster that we got. But Scott, I'll let you talk about Savage and where he came from in his debut.
Well, we'll quickly go over. Before I do that, though, let's quickly recap George Steele, because I want to back up something that you just said about his character annoying you. George Steele was such a better heel in the late 70s into the early 80s. He was in, I think he was in Freddie Blassie's faction with, or maybe it was Fuji's. I have to look that up. He was with one of these two, one of those managers.
He was with Albano, wasn't he?
That's right. He was with Captain Lou. But I thought he was with Captain Lou after he turned face. Was he with it? Yeah, no, you're right. He was, because he was with, like, he was with Volkoff and Sheik and some guys that Captain Lou was with before he turned face. So, but he was definitely a better heel. He was a better heel. As for Savage, let's go through the background. Savage was obviously the son of Angelo Poffo, and some younger wrestling fans may not know he's actually Leaping Lanny Poffo's big brother. So yeah, his name is Randy Poffo, obviously. He was a well-known minor league baseball player. He had a pretty good, actually had a cup of coffee with the Cardinals sometime in his career. Then he went into wrestling, and he's pretty much spent most of his career in Memphis. He was with his dad's federation, because actually, believe it or not, Jerry Lawler's promotion in Memphis actually had a competition,
mm-hmm.
and Angelo Poffo actually had his own promotion. They ended up merging because
Time when he created it was kind of like a rogue promotion, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of like an early kind of rudimentary NWO, if you will,
right?
And
or even ECW style from. You know, what I've been told is there's a lot of violence and crazy matches, and they pretty much just ran down. The whole point was to try and invade Memphis and kind of try and put Lawler out of business. So yeah. It was kind of an interesting concept early on in the 80s.
It was. And once Savage went to Memphis, went to Lawler's promotion, they actually had some great feuds. The two of them as a tag team, they wrestled each other. Savage feuded with Rick Rude when he debuted there, and we'll get more into Rude in our next podcast, our next review podcast. But... he definitely had a good, but he got stuck in the Memphis way of doing things, and we see a lot of that in this match. Obviously, the Memphis style of wrestling is build the crowd up with stalling, get them pissed off that you're taking forever, you're dawdling around the ring, you're futzing around on the floor, you're talking to the front row, and you're really getting the crowd, you know, agitated by not getting in the ring, getting going. Eventually, Savage would obviously get out of that habit,
mm-hmm.
and become one of the greatest of all time. But this match, he is totally in Memphis mode here. And on top of the fact that, and I agree with Justin on this, I don't know about you, Matt. I know George Steele's, because you're a connoisseur of crap. So George Steele's match is probably one of your favorite guys, but this match, just it's just two stalling guys, and you have Steele, who doesn't have a lot of ability, and you have Savage, who's not using any of his ability, and this match is just one utter disaster.
Right, and the angle behind it was that Steele, you know, was the dumb, animalistic guy that was in love with the beautiful Elizabeth. So he kept, you know, innocently giving her flowers and, you know, hitting on her indirectly. And Savage was the insane, jealous boyfriend, or, you know, I'm not sure if they had acknowledged that they were dating or anything at that point. But he was jealous, so he, you know, attacked Steele. And anytime Steele gave her anything, flowers or anything like that, he'd bust them up and rip them apart. Like, I think he does that here, actually. So the angle was pretty good. It's just that Steele was, at this point, is just, you know, awful to watch in the ring. And then to have this go 7 minutes, it felt like 30 to me. You know, as they just kind of parade around the ring slowly, and then Savage just weakly rolls him up in the corner. So I just think they could have done something a lot better than what they did.
Yeah. Matt, what do you think about your guy here? The Animal.
The Animal? Yeah, he was never my favorite in the ring. I just enjoyed watching him mutilate a turnbuckle, but this match was just boring. I remember I didn't like it either. I'm with Justin on this one. I really hated it. It just had no flow to it at all. I have really not too much to say about that match. Kind of try to forget about it, really.
Yeah, like, I'd be like, happy never seeing it again. I can definitely say that.
Yeah, it's, and you know, again, I did have a soft spot for this show just because I was there. But yeah, when you watch it as an analyst, or you watch it as a
anyone not you.
Yeah, well, yeah, pretty much. Yeah. But, you know, it is tough to watch because it is just so bad. So, in essence, this show is 0-2 so far. These first two matches are absolutely atrocious. Mm-hmm.
It gets worse as you go along.
Well, starting with this next one.
It just continues.
You wanted to talk about why Magnificent Morocco and Paul Orndorff started this match. You try this next match. You wonder why this was even considered a WrestleMania match.
Mm-hmm.
The next match is... George Wells, who, I'd like to kind of help out our younger wrestling fans. You're wondering who the hell George Wells is. Well, actually, he was a football player, but believe it or not, he was actually a fairly successful guy in WWF in the mid '80s. I was watching a house show on one of our 24/7 tapes that our good friend Mr. Rosero compiles for me, and he actually won a couple of house show matches over a stretch of '84, '85, and I think Vince actually liked him for future things. He had Vince's look, mm-hmm. big bulked up guy. So I think he, you know, I don't think it was a guy that Vince wanted to crap all over, but by the time obviously 1986 rolled around, there were plenty of other guys in the roster Vince liked, including this guy who makes his pay-per-view debut here, and that is Aurelian Smith Jr. Obviously that's not his stage name, but that is his stage name is of course Jake the Snake Roberts, who makes his pay-per-view debut here. The Snake had a pretty, well, Justin, why don't you let us know about the career of the Snake heading into this match.
Yeah, he had some success in the NWA, mainly down in Florida, with Kevin Sullivan and his insane group there of maniacs. Jake was one of them, and that's, you could tell where he got a lot of his talking style and his attitude was from Sullivan. A lot of the, you know, satanic style stuff and the dark stuff that he would break out in a lot of his promos. After that, he hit up Georgia, where he was with Paul Ellering and King Kong Bundy, Hawk, Iron Sheik, the original Sheik. It was kind of a who's who of crazed heels that he worked with. After spending some time in Mid-South, he jumped over to WWF, and that's where we come in now. He debuted in, was it 86 or late 85? I think it was 86.
It was late 85. I think he was at a Garden House show like in December of 85. So, but Matt, I want to read off this faction of guys to you, because this group of guys is right up your alley.
Sounds right. Good to me.
King Kong Bundy, Hawk and Animal, Buzz Sawyer, the Iron Sheik, Luke Graham, the original Sheik, and Triple K, Killer Karl Krupp.
Best thing since Triple H.
Hey, this Triple K, yes. I wonder if there was ever... Well, they couldn't really say KKK. I'm sure that would have gone over well in the South.
It was actually one of my most hated wrestlers. I can't really stand him, Buzz Sawyer. I never could stand him. I still can't to this day. I know he's dead, but I still can't stand him.
That's okay. There's a lot of guys we don't like that are dead. But
yeah, Buzz Sawyer was pretty annoying.
I actually liked him when he was in NWA. and when he was actually feuding with Flair and the burgeoning Horsemen in late 85. He actually, I never really had that problem with him there, but there were other times. It's just based on, you know, a lot of times with a lot of these guys, it's based on what the character's made for in each promotion. Mm-hmm. I never had a problem with him in NWA, but anyway, Buzz Sawyer was not at the show. I don't think Vince would have ever hired him anyway.
Probably not.
Again, James
Lord for that one.
makes his debut here. And again, the match is a complete, utter piece of crap.
Yeah, it's basically a squash. I mean, this definitely belonged on a house show or on a weekend show. But, I mean, I get it. You know, we've had pay-per-views that we're going to review since this one where they have matches like this. Jobber to the Stars guy, like George Wells, puts over the new guy. It was quick, 3 minutes, inoffensive. Jake looks like a monster, you know, destroying Wells, putting the snake on him. So I'm actually fine with this one. The only thing that hurts it is that the rest of the card is so shitty that it kind of lumps it all together, whereas this would be fine if it was a card full of better matches.
Yeah, I think this match gets forgotten sometimes because, A, no one remembers who George Wells is ever again. And again, like you said, it's just wrapped around more crap. So I kind of feel bad for Jake here. He kind of gets lost in the shuffle. He actually has a pretty decent rest of 86. I think he actually gets a couple of matches with Hogan in the summertime.
Yeah, and we get the Ricky Steamboat feud as well that comes later.
Yeah. Yes, which is tremendous.
But compounding all the crap is this Susan St. James with her constant, "Oh, George, come on, George," between George Steele and George Wells. And it was just pretty much 10 minutes straight of, "Oh, George, come on, George."
Oh, God. And at the time, the other problem, actually, of this was that Vince was just hideous. Vince really didn't get into his good babyface. Well, I shouldn't say that because let me rephrase that. He was pretty good when he was by himself, because you and I, Justin, have watched some house shows from like 82.
Yeah, he was good in those. Yeah, he was good when he's by himself in those early 80s shows.
Yeah, but when he had an opponent, a partner, I don't think he really knew. I don't think he really knew how to bounce things off. And when you're dealing with somebody who knows nothing about what they're watching, it's even worse. At least when he had guys like back then, like Pat Patterson would do some color and some other guys like that. You know, mm-hmm. Billy Red Lions whenever they went to Maple Leaf Gardens, but. But when you have somebody, when Vince was just trying to get himself into a groove of the new way of announcing for TV, and then you've got Susan St. James, who, as we've said ad nauseum tonight, is truly clueless. On top of the bad announcing and the bad matches, this first part, I really feel bad for anybody for these 16,000 people that paid for tickets to the show because
yeah, it's pretty awful.
It's pretty hideous.
I just want to make a quick question to Scott here. Mm-hmm. When you were mentioning about this match, how it was kind of forgotten, you kind of felt bad for Jake Roberts. Why the heck would you remember this match? It means nothing. It's a match that, as Justin said, should never have been on the card anyway, or probably shouldn't have been. They just put it in there for time's sake. But it's a match that I don't think anyone would ever remember or should really remember.
Well, I think it was more just to put the Jay character over a little more. Like I said, he started in December, but I don't think he really got a full... He hadn't been doing his talk show yet. At least I don't think he has. No, I don't think he has yet. When he started the Snake Pit. I don't think he started doing that until summertime. You know, maybe he belonged on the Chicago portion of the show, which we're starting momentarily. But it's just unfortunate that you have another debut. It's not just him. I mean, Savage was debuting in this portion of the show. And mm-hmm. He gets a colossal piece of crap, too. Although he's partially to blame because he was still in that Memphis stalling thing, but I don't know. I'm not quite sure what you were trying to ask, but I don't know. I think that Jake was
it's
such
pretty
a great...
much. It's pretty much. I was just wondering why you would. You kind of sounded like you wish people would remember this match more.
Well, I wish that that Jake kind of was more remembered because his he was such a great character, and he would end up becoming a great character anyway, but I agree with Justin that this was a good enough squash, and then the snake came out, and it was so dramatic, and he had the purple tights with the big snake on him, and it was this whole thing that really, it seemed like Jake was trying so hard to put this over, and unfortunately, the match was a colossal piece of crap, and this first part of the show was that it just kind of gets forgotten. So I just wish that it was more remembered for that, because it was a pretty effective squash, and Jake really showed his good charisma in the ring, and unfortunately the match gets forgotten because the rest of the part of the show is garbage. So.
And it's followed by this, depending on how you look at it, could be considered a mess, it could be considered entertaining. I guess it's a mess because it was counted on to anchor this portion of the show, but that's Mr. T following up on his WrestleMania 1 appearance, facing Roddy Piper in a boxing match. Of course, Mr. T coming off Rocky 3, where he played a boxer, and then Piper, always known as a street fighter, so they throw on the boxing gloves here. They had some pretty good build-up where Bob Orton was also taking up boxing, and that kind of is what led up to this, where he was knocking out jobbers, and then Mr. T challenged him, so they had a boxing match. Piper came in, they beat the crap out of T, so that set this up. And then, of course, we had the famous, or infamous, Roddy Piper and Orton shaving the midget wrestler, the Haiti Kid's head, to look like Mr. T, giving him the mohawk. So Haiti Kid, you know, was with T in his corner. So we had a lot going on. Lou Duva was a manager or corner man for Piper, and Smokin' Joe Frazier was with T. So a lot going on here. Celebrities all over the place. T back in the mix. And this is entertaining, I'll say that. It's fun, but it's just the fact that it was counted on to be such a major match is kind of what is disappointing to me.
I thought that the build-up was pretty good. I mean, that was a pretty good Saturday night's main event. We'll talk about the other big thing that happened at that show a little bit later on. But that was huge. I mean, Piper, there was a lot of controversy there, too, because they were whipping Mr. T with a weightlifting belt. And that was very controversial at the time. I remember people talking, you know, about, you know, these two white guys whipping a black guy in the middle of a ring. And I remember there was a little bit of tension about that. And then it kind of faded by the time I got to WrestleMania. But you know what? Vince started getting to that point where, you know what, any publicity is good publicity. So, the worst thing about this match, and Matt, I'm actually curious for your opinion on this because this is your favorite guy. But the first round of the fight is actually not bad. Because Piper used to be a boxer, and Mr. T obviously can fake it pretty well. He did it in Rocky 3. So the first round actually wasn't bad. They actually, you know, had the movements, and they were getting the punches off. And then by the second round, you could tell they were dancing and futzing around, and they weren't really hitting each other. And it was at that point, it even looked faker than the wrestling would be. So that's what killed that match. And obviously, Susan St. James commentating wasn't getting much better. But it just seemed like the realism of the boxing. I mean, at least they get the boxing right, and they just couldn't even get that right. That just got – by the second round, that was just awful to watch. So I don't know what you think, Matt, because this is your favorite guy.
I'm a huge Roddy Piper fan. He's my favorite of all time, but if I had to pick a match that was my least favorite that he ever did, even though it's not even a wrestling match, it was probably this one. I couldn't – for the moment it started off, I hated it. And until the end, I hated it. The only time I really liked it was when he finally – ended it with a DQ, even though it's kind of a cheap way out. It really didn't help this card at all. I was just glad to see the match finally over.
Well, as we know, too, I mean, Piper never really laid down for anyone, so there was no way he was going to lay down for T. That was obvious. And I guess, you know, I can understand why they wouldn't want T to, you know, T didn't want to get knocked out by a wrestler. So I get the cheap finish, I guess. Like you said, the whole thing is it was more for spectacle. I mean, you look at WrestleMania 1, it was kind of along those lines where they just wanted to get the stars out there. And like I said, I would have been fine with it if they weren't counting on it to be an anchor. But it does bring an end to the New York portion. Do you guys have any comments on New York before we move ahead to Chicago?
Yeah, I feel bad for those that bought the tickets. That was just one colossal piece of crap after another.
Yeah.
And I feel bad for them because that was just terrible.
I mean, based on our grades, the highest we gave individually was 1.5. So, I mean, that's pretty awful for 4 matches.
Yeah. I would have spent those matches on superstars, not a WrestleMania card. But as you said, this is a very early form of WrestleMania. It never really took place with the WrestleMania that we know until next year.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point, Matt. Actually, the Jake George Wells match actually is probably was a superstars match at some point in 1986. They probably wrestled each other again. Who knows? But yeah, that's just low rent. I felt bad for those people in Nassau. Those tickets probably weren't cheap.
Not at all. So let's move along then to Chicago's Rosemont Horizon, 9,000 in attendance, and the announcers here are Gorilla Monsoon, Gene Okerlund, who often announced on various house shows with Gorilla. But we never really hear him on a major pay-per-view outside of this one here. So this is really his only major pay-per-view commentary job. And Kathy Lee Crosby, who I believe was another actress. We'll leave that one up to Scott again. Go ahead, Scott. Fill us in.
Kathy Lee Crosby was indeed an actress. She, if there was a show, you guys probably don't remember. This was actually early 80s. I barely remember it, but I remember being on TV. It was a show called That's Incredible. It had her, John Davidson, former actor, and Fran Tarkenton, who used to be a quarterback. Your pal there, Matt, Fran Tarkenton, quarterback for the Vikings. They used to do shows like all this crazy stories about ghosts and, like, you know, super smart kids and crap like that. But she was an actress on other shows, too. And she was kind of hot. So it fit from that perspective. But again, another woman, I should say that, that wouldn't sound right, but another celebrity who just didn't know what she was doing.
Yeah.
And badly faked it. And honestly, I got to be honest with you. Let me just get this. I get this out before you move on. I absolutely could not stand hearing Gorilla and Mean Gene do commentary on those house shows. They are unlistenable. There's too much. You got to have some kind of heel tinge on these and any kind of wrestling match, any.
Yeah, and
the two of them were just so sugary, it was nauseating.
And they're extra bad too in my eyes, because at least when you have Gorilla and Alfred, you know, Alfred's kind of got that novelty of the English stuff, and he'd, you know, say things wrong, and he'd always, you know, play up a little bit of heel, but I know what you mean. When you have those two saccharine faces, it's just overpowering, and I believe they actually did the war to settle the score, didn't they? Or was that Vince and Oakland?
Yes, they did.
It was Gorilla, right?
No, it was Gorilla. It was Gorilla Mean Gene, yeah. Thank God the show, the card itself was actually very good, because the two of them were just awful.
Yeah, so those two, they don't help things. And then I thought Susan St. James was actually better than Kathy Lee Crosby, but at least there were two people to help carry Kathy Lee, whereas, you know, Vince had Susan St. James on his own. But these two don't get much to talk about either until a little bit later in their night, but they start off with a women's title match with the Fabulous Moolah back on top after, you know, last review we talked about how Wendi Richter won the women's championship back from Leilani Kai. Well, later in that year, Vince wanted Wendi Richter to sign a contract. She refused, or I forget what the deal was. Something with me, it was a pay cut, or he wanted an exclusive deal. Either way, Richter wanted no part of it. So he had Moolah go out there under a mask as the Spider Lady and force Richter's shoulders to the mat, pinned her, and the ref counted three. So it was basically the original Montreal Screwjob happened in that match, where he got the women's title off Richter. Richter left and never returned until she was inducted into the Hall of Fame a couple years ago. So Moolah's got the title back around her waist, and by this point, she's still a heel, still ticking along, and she fights Velvet McIntyre, who was just random women's challenger du jour. I believe she was from, like, Australia or New Zealand or something. So this match is nothing again. It's less than a minute. Velvet misses a splash. Moolah rolls her up and keeps on her endless championship reigns.
There's a rumor, I don't remember where I read it. I thought you and I were talking about this, but there was a rumor that the reason the match was so short is because Velvet McIntyre blew her knee out, and they needed to go home, you know, quick. I don't know if they did the X back then like they did during the Attitude Era, but that's why the match is 53 seconds. Apparently it was supposed to be longer, but that's what I heard. And then that Velvet McIntyre blew her knee out or something in the match, and they had to go home with it pretty quick. But it's kind of unfortunate. I mean, really, I've never this show circled the bowl very quickly. And mm-hmm. I guess when you're a young kid, 9-10 years old, who thinks about it like that? But now that you watch it again, it's just so bad. this was just bad. I can't believe at this point that they didn't take the belt off Moolah and give it to somebody. And Velvet McIntyre would win the belt at some point in the future. But I don't know if she was meant to win it here. I don't know what was going on. But I thought they would have taken it off Moolah by this point.
I gotta disagree with both of you on this match. I know how you both hated it. Loved it. I love it for the one mere fact that it was a quick match and that it was over in 53 seconds. That's the main reason that this was a great match.
Yeah, so I guess that's the only positive.
So you didn't really care about the quality of the fact that it was expeditious was right up your alley.
Well, the women's wrestling at this period of time was atrocious. You had Fabulous Moolah facing off all these stiffs that no one knew, and then it gets even worse with the Glamour Girls down the line, but it was just never-ending bad women wrestling.
And Scott, I know you mentioned that Velvet wins the title later. I think she won it on some tour. I think it was like a tour of Australia, and she won it and lost it right back. I think it was one of those jobs where, you know, just kind of give the hometown person a pop. I'm pretty sure that's where her title reign came in. I don't think she ever did much more than that. Or is she from Ireland? Maybe. I'm way off. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about Australia.
No, I think she's Australian. Let me see. No, she was Irish.
Okay, so I'm way off.
She's born in Ireland. She resides in Vancouver, British Columbia. She did hold the women's championship. Let's see when it happened. WrestleMania 2. Moolah defeated McIntyre to she won the title. She defeated Moolah in Australia.
Okay,
on
so
July
it was
3rd,
Australia.
1980. Yeah, on July 3rd, 1980. She's from Ireland, but the match was in Australia.
Okay.
On July 3rd, 1986, and she lost it 6 days later.
Okay, that makes sense. And then they fought. So that came after this. Yes. Okay, so that's really it for that. We don't need to spend any more time on this debacle. And the next debacle is Corporal Kirchner against Nikolai Volkov at a flag match.
Did Kirchner die or something recently?
No, that's what everybody thought. They thought he T-boned his truck in Connecticut.
Yeah, he's still...
I feel like dying after watching this match, though.
what is going on here? This is just hideous. Terrible. This match has no excuse to be this bad. I'm sorry.
Well, Kirchner was just a Slaughter ripoff, basically, right?
Well, he was Slaughter in better shape. But yeah. My point is why
he was Scott Baio in a uniform.
That sounds like one of your dreams or a poster you'd have on your wall.
You wish Scott Baio had a camouflage tank top on in your room. But
don't we all?
We'll let you on. I was always disappointed in this match because I remember Corporal Kirchner being on. He was pretty over with the crowd, and he didn't have Slaughter's ability or charisma, but you know, it gave Nikolai something to do. But I never understood. I mean, you watch this match, and literally, it's a blink of an eye. I don't even think it's a minute 34. I think that's a misnomer. It must be like 50 seconds. I think the Moolah match was longer. It just seemed like this match was so fast, and I don't know. I don't know what Vince was thinking. Like, who booked this crap?
It's pretty awful.
To borrow the DX sign from 97. I mean, really, it's just, every match is garbage. I mean, I can't believe they would have been impressed with this. I mean, this is just one colossal piece of crap after another. I mean, it's pretty hideous. You know, I think Vince was so, and maybe when we get to LA, obviously when we get to LA, the end of this show, and then this city, and then we head to the next city. But, I don't know, it just seemed like Vince cared more about the semantics of this show than he did he cared more about the sizzle and not enough about the steak.
Yeah, I agree.
Because this, did he even realize these matches were going on? I mean, it's just awful.
Yeah, I mean, a minute 34, like you said, is probably even less. Kirchner gets a win. Gets the flag. Nobody cares. Volkov lays down. He probably should have won because he was better. But I understand why Kirchner won. But I don't think anyone cared. So let's just move on to the what I consider the two real big matches here in Chicago. First one is a battle royal featuring wrestling WWF stars and NFL players, which I thought was a pretty interesting concept. It was a good mix they had. The wrestlers involved were Ted Arcidi, Tony Atlas, Brian Blair, and Jim Brunzell. Debuting Bret Hart, Hillbilly Jim, Iron Sheik, King Tonga, Pedro Morales, Jim Neidhart, Bruno Sammartino, who wrestles here but did not wrestle last year at WrestleMania 1 for reasons we still don't understand,
no,
Danny Spivey, and Big John Studd, and Andre the Giant. So those were the WWF stars that were in there. And then the NFL players were Jimbo Covert, Bill Frelick, Russ Francis, Ernie Holmes, Harvey Martin, and Refrigerator Perry. And outside the ring were Dick Butkus and Ed Too Tall Jones, who were the special enforcer referees.
Yes. Actually, Ed Too Tall Jones, still playing for the Cowboys at the time, was actually supposed to be in the Battle Royal, because it's in my program that he was one of the participants. But he got hurt, and the NFL Players Union would not let him wrestle. So that's where Ernie Holmes came in. Ernie Holmes was the last-minute replacement, because he was retired by then.
Oh, okay.
So that's what that was. Bill Frelick played for the Falcons. He was a rookie, I think, actually. And obviously, Covert and William Perry were there to spike the Chicago crowd because they were both on the Bears and they just won the Super Bowl 3 months earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Russ Francis, actually, his father was a wrestler, so I think they picked him because he had at least knew what was going on. So in terms of the sizzle of this, the NFL player picks were not that bad, and at least there were some decent. And in terms of the wrestling guys, there was actually plenty of talent except for Ted Arcidi.
Why are you dissing Arcidi?
He was the worst meathead I think I've ever seen in my life. I would have rather taken Ken Patera's hairless legs than having a look at Ted Arcidi. The guy was awful. And he had the thickest – this is not a knock on Bostonians, but he had the thickest Boston accent I think I've ever heard in my life. I mean, I don't think you can understand anything he was saying in any of his promos.
Obviously, you forget about the meathead known as Iron Mike Sharp. You can understand a word he said either.
He was Canadian, all right? Yeah. And he was special. So Ted Arcidi was not. So,
well, I mean, the good thing here too is you get a lot of like throwback guys in you know, Tony Atlas, Bruno, Pedro Morales. So it was kind of a good nostalgic kick almost for the Chicago crowd. And then I thought it was good to capitalize on the popularity of football in Chicago at this point. Like you said, the Bears had just won the Super Bowl, one of the most dominant teams of all time. So I think it was good. I think it was a smart move, and it's another match like the Jake and George Wells one, where maybe it wouldn't stand out as being kind of a mess as much if there was a better card around it, if it was seen, looked at as more of a gimmick instead of a match that had to carry the card.
Exactly, and one thing we really need to point out here is, there's plenty of debuts, obviously, a lot of guys that were not at WrestleMania 1, but obviously for you fans that, you know, again, are maybe a little younger and know some names here but don't know others, this is obviously Bret Hart's pay-per-view debut, the start of a very long and flourishing wrestling career.
Yeah, should we talk about him here, or do you want to wait till WrestleMania 3 to get
into we'll delve more into WrestleMania 3 because he's actually in the in a big match and everything. Okay. Like that. I'm just saying this is the first time he's on camera in WrestleMania history.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, another tag team debuts here, not as a team, but in this match, and that's the Killer Bees. Jim Brunzel, who was in that same Vern Gagne class with the Iron Sheik and Ric Flair in 1973. Brian Blair's from Florida. Tony Atlas, obviously, a legend in the early 80s in wrestling. King Tonga, who of course many would know eventually as Haku. Pedro Morales passed his prime but was in there to, you know, spike the crowd. Danny Spivey, I think Danny Spivey was meant for actually big things at this point.
I agree.
Think they liked his look. He was in NWA as what the hell was his name? Starship something. I have to look that up. He had like this really crazy name in NWA, and that's where he got his fuzzy boots. He actually had fuzzy boots in this match. Let me see what it is. He had a crazy name.
Now this is after his run with Rotundo, right? Because Rotundo's obviously gone at this
point. Yeah, Rotundo was gone already.
Yeah, so they had teamed up in late 85. Spivey kind of sticks around until here, and then I don't think he makes it much past 86 with the WWF before heading back to NWA.
He makes a big run. Sorry, I just want to say he actually does a pretty good 2 or 3 year run in NWA after that. He actually gets a couple of title matches. He's obviously, but we'll get to that when we get there. But yeah, he had the look, but Vince just didn't have enough for him. But then he let him go.
And also debuting is Jim Neidhart, who was a tag team partner with Bret Hart as the Hart Foundation. But before Bret made his way in, he was a single star. He was a former football player, former track star. Another big guy they brought in. He's actually a pretty good talker. And if you watch some of those early or late 86 or early 87 promos that the Harts do, he was really the one carrying those promos. I think he's kind of underrated as a talker. But we'll get more into the Hart Foundation, like you said, at WrestleMania 3 in our next review. But Bret Hart did come from Canada, son of the legendary Stu Hart. Was a big part of Stampede Wrestling. But when Stampede was bought by Vince, Stu made him, or asked him to take Bret and then two other guys that we'll get to in a moment as part of the deal. So
I just wanted to mention in this match, the football player Russ Francis.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually kind of impressed with him, how he always was staying in the match. He had that Terry Funk grab onto the rope type technique that he used throughout the match. Even though it wasn't a long battle royal, he did impress me as far as a football star trying to do a wrestling match.
Well, again, he, you know, his dad was a former wrestler, so he kind of knew what was going on, and I agree with you 100%. I think it was good that he kind of knew what was going on and made the match kind of legit. I was impressed by that as well. I just looked up, I just found our good friend, Dan Spivey. Is that his actual name? Yeah, it's Dan Spivey. He actually worked out in Florida with Scott Hall. We all know who he would become eventually. He was trained by Dusty Rhodes in Florida. Rick Martel and Barry Windham actually did some training with him as well. He was actually – Spivey and Hall were a masked tag team in the NWA, and they were called American Starship.
That's right, yeah.
Spivey was Eagle, and Hall was Coyote. So, yeah. So Dan Spivey's name in the NWA was American Starship Eagle, which is a lot for one name.
Beautiful. Well, it's better than I believe it's Duke of Dorchester, Pete Doherty, on his awful commentary in some of those old house shows, used to call him Spivvy, Dan Spivvy.
Yeah, Spivvy. We gotta find the Houston house show when we gotta find that. I knew you were gonna get him going. going at some point. We got to find the Houston House show where he tells Mike McGurk to go bake a cake in the kitchen.
Oh, he's awful. He is so bad.
It was entertaining, though. It was, like, hideous entertaining. It was like a car wreck.
Well, it was him. That one Houston House show, I think it was from, like, late 87. It was Pete Doherty, Mike McGurk, and Bruce Pritchard.
And Bruce Pritchard.
Oh,
yeah.
It was terrible.
The pre-brother love. It was and the sad thing was it was a very memorable show because it was like the Paul Bosch tribute show. Paul Bosch, for those that don't know, was a major promoter in the Houston area, kind of like Fritz Von Erich in Dallas. And this was like in 87, I think. And it was just – but I agree with Justin. It's – as if you're analyzing the announcing, it's downright atrocious. But when he keeps calling him Spivvy, and then he tells Mike McGurk – he tells – oh, come on, Spivvy. And then he tells Mike McGurk to go bake a cake.
Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. But so right I don't think he's going to make it. So, but let's just to kind of wrap this up. Andre wins the match. Yes. He throws Bret Hart out to win it on top of the anvil. Gets his big moment in the sun, kind of a, you know, final face moment in the sun before his major heel turn that we'll get to next time out at WrestleMania 3. So that's it. Andre wins. Be still the reigning king of the Battle Royals. So. Our next match and final one in Chicago, we have the debut of a new team, the British Bulldogs, and they face the Dream Team for the WWF Tag Team titles. The Dream Team consisting of Brutus Beefcake and Greg Valentine. After WrestleMania 1, they teamed up under the management of Luscious Johnny V, and they defeated the U.S. Express for the Tag Team titles. After they won the back from Sheik and Volkoff, the Dream Team won them from them in late 85. So they... are the champions heading in here, and they face off against the British Bulldogs, comprised of the Davey Boy Smith and the Dynamite Kid, both out of Stampede Wrestling. And these are the two other guys that Stu Hart made sure Vince signed at the time when his company was going under. And he sold to Vince. He asked him to sign Brett, Davey Boy, and Dynamite, the three linchpins of Stampede Wrestling. Dynamite, I'm sure most fans know about. If you've read his book, you know more about him than you probably ever need to know. He was... a short guy, compact guy, loaded up on lots of steroids, pretty insane outside the ring, even more insane inside the ring, where he would, you know, put it on the line, did his crazy diving headbutt, falls off the top rope, just worked a stiff style. Davey Boy at this point was pretty jacked up himself, not as big as he'd get eventually, so he was actually pretty mobile still here, and they were hard workers. They definitely busted their ass, and this match here, I believe we're all pretty much in agreement that this is the match of the night.
I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, you had two... well, athletic tag teams. Vince was no dummy, and really neither was Stu. Stu knew who his best guys were up there, and it was those three. It was Brett, Bulldog, and Dynamite. And you're wondering about, and I know a lot of you are wondering about Neidhart. Neidhart had already left. Neidhart had left on his own Stampede, and then was in the World Wrestling Federation before Brett got there.
Right.
And so he's not part of that group. That's why we're not mentioning him here, because he wasn't part of that group.
Was Neidhart even? Was he even in Stampede? I thought he came from somewhere else.
Well, I mean, he had to have been up there because he married Brett's sister.
Oh, that's right.
So I'm assuming he had to have been up there for at some point. I'm sure he didn't wrestle there a lot. He definitely went to WWF before these other.
You're
guys.
You're right. I'm sorry. Yeah, he trained with Stu. You're right. I don't know why I thought he didn't. Yeah, he did.
Yeah, and he married one of the less good-looking daughters. If you ever watched the Heart and Soul DVD. She's not
Ellie.
He's not exactly that attractive of a man either. So
well, he wasn't bad looking back in those days. He didn't have his beard wasn't as long back then.
And he didn't have the huge gut that he would get later.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But the 12 turkeys he has in there now.
Yes. Yes. You come on. You wanted to get a who mask.
Oh, who was awesome. he could carry that gimmick to the world championship if he was given the proper time.
Yeah, if you were booking it. But anyway.
Who would have?
Neidhart.
Who?
Exactly. Who?
Who? Okay, let's move on.
Okay. Anyway, this is actually, Justin's 100% right. This is the best match of the night. And the crowd was into it. Ozzy was there, and Ozzy Osbourne was in the Bulldogs corner. So, and of course, you know, the only bad thing about this, and you always bring this up, Justin, is that, you know, this was the part of his career where Captain Lou would glom onto every...
Oh, God, why'd you remind me? Why did you remind me? I forgot all about it.
He glom onto every tag team so he can jack up his tag team champion's resume.
It must have really pissed you off when he started glomming on with the head shrinkers in mid-90s.
That was the worst. Because he wasn't even with the company that much. here I am. I'm managing the head shrinkers. That was awful.
What really pissed me off. What pissed me off is that he, you know, he's always bragging. I've managed 24 tag team champions. Well, yeah, of course he would become the manager a week before they had the title shot. They'd win the title, and then when they left, you know, he'd leave the team and move on to the next one. So of course you can have 24. What a joke! I don't hate many guys. Like I said, George Steele being one of them, and Captain Lou's the other. I could never stand him.
One day we're going to do a podcast just on every 80s manager that Justin hates. So you could never really enjoy a six-man tag of Captain Lou, Frenchie Martin, and Mr. Fuji?
I don't hate Fuji. I just don't see what he ever did for his guys. He just kind of stood there and made faces. Frenchie Martin and Captain Lou I do not like. Especially Frenchie Martin. That guy was just freaking useless, but...
And his house show matches were all when he was actually wrestling. Frenchie Martin and Outback Jack was like, I'd rather have my eyes gouged out with a spoon. Those matches were awful.
Terrible.
It was gold.
We're not even.
Frenchie Martin should have teamed with Rene Goulet. It would have been awesome.
They each could have had their own studded gloves. But anyway, this match is actually very good. And a funny thing that people don't remember about this match, if you remember the end, Davey Boy whips Valentine into the ropes and hits Bulldog Dynamite in the head. Dynamite's on the top rope about to do something. He gets hit. He and Valentine butt heads. Dynamite falls off the top rope onto the floor, and then Davey Boy pins Valentine and wins the match. Place goes bonkers. Definitely the highlight of the show. But what's interesting is that the cameras don't go onto Dynamite. Because he actually got busted open, and this was in the pre-blood. Well, I shouldn't say that because we see blood later on, but apparently it was pretty gruesome. I mean, he got his head was cut open like a melon.
And he was knocked. I think he was knocked silly, right? He said, I think he was out of it during the celebration.
Yeah,
and they kind of had to carry him.
Yeah, I think I read that Pat Patterson. I think Pat had to come out and actually sit him down and kind of get his bearings about him. So it was mostly, and I think Ozzy did the best job of kind of. Killing, the, you know, getting the crowd going and kind of keeping them hot while Dynamite remembered his name. But
the sickest spot of the match, I thought, outside of that headbutt, was a nasty, nasty Valentine pile driver that Dynamite takes. Definitely was always stands on my mind. And this was just, you know, 12 stiff minutes. These four guys just beat the crap out of each other. Four guys who like to hit it hard. Especially, you know, a lot of people know Beefcake for his later years where he was kind of sloppy in the ring. But at this point, I think he was learning really well from teaming with Valentine, just, you know, how to work a stiff heel style. And he was starting to come around at this point.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people thought after his debacle at the first WrestleMania, but really this was a perfect, perfect move for Beefcake's career. He had a team with a very good, experienced wrestler and a good, experienced manager that could help him, you know, get his character over. So Beefcake was in a perfect position here.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a pretty good job, and he was the good-looking guy, and Valentine was the workhorse. And he was actually one of my brother's favorite tag teams. He loved the Dream Team because he's a big Valentine guy. But I was big in the Bulldogs. My dad was a big Bulldogs fan. We were like high-five, and the Coliseum was going crazy. It was definitely the highlight, obviously next to the main event, but this was probably the highlight of the night. I mean, the crowd just went absolutely crazy. And it was a big win for the Bulldogs.
Yep, and while that was the match of the night, I think we now move on to the portion, the crowd that got the best, you know, overall card of the night. They might not have had the best match, but I think, you know, when you look at the matches they did get, I think if you were in the LA Sports Arena in Los Angeles, California, you definitely made out the best of the three arenas. Unfortunately for us at home, we did not, as the announcers were the great Jesse Ventura, the sometimes great Lord Alfred Hayes, and the never great Elvira, who wasn't quite an actress. I believe she was like a movie host, right? She hosted like horror movies on TV or something like that.
Yeah, she was she did it on Channel 38, obviously for us New Englanders, Channel 38 WSBK. She used to do Saturday night. You know, she would host. You know, she was kind of the precursor to Rhonda Shear on USA in the early 90s, except Rhonda Shear hosted absolute crap movies. Elvira actually did legitimately decent horror movies, like old stuff like Creature from the Black Lagoon and, you know, right. Frankenstein, things like that.
Didn't she used to date the Crypt Keeper?
What? Crypt Keeper was a puppet. What is wrong with you? What, do you think of the Yeti?
I think Matt's a puppet.
Pretty much. I know you want us to get to the Yeti, but that's quite a number of years off. Anyway, the opener of this show is actually a very good match. I liked it. Ricky Steamboat, who, it's Ricky Steamboat, there's really not much you need to say.
Yep.
Against a newcomer to the scene, Hercules Hernandez, who kind of bounced around the Midwest. He was in Mid-South. He was in World Class for Fritz. And he actually had the television championship in World Class. There he wore a mask.
Right.
But then when he came here, he had his big, long, you know, curly, permed mullet, wearing the Centurion garb with the, you know, chest protector and all that kind of stuff. And again, we're talking Steamboat here, so really nothing's ever awful.
Right.
2.5 stars with Hercules is that's what Justin and I both graded it. It's pretty good. It's 5 stars for anybody else.
Yeah, so. I definitely like this match. Steamboat worked hard. Hercules keeps up with him. It worked out because if Hercules could use his power offense to beat on Steamboat, and Steamboat's, you know, main asset or attribute rather was his selling, you know, in addition to his smooth ring work. So he definitely they meshed well. This was a good 7 minutes. Probably one of the better matches on the card. One of my favorite Hercules moments that would come later is when, what was that announcer's name? Ron Trongard on one of the house shows kept calling him yes. Hercules Cortez, who I think is another wrestler down in, I think he was in Florida or something like that. So that always gave me a laugh.
I'm going to have to look that up now. Hercules Cortez. That's, then again, Ron Trongard was like 150 years old.
That was awful. He's like, Hercules, I'm bringing in Hercules Cortez right now.
Oh, my God. Oh, God. Here it is. Ruben Cruz, known by his ring name Hercules Ayala, is a retired Puerto Rican professional wrestler. No, that's not him. No, well, this is another guy who has competed in Canadian international wrestling promotions, including the Eastern Canadian Grand Prix Wrestling, the Calgary-based Stampede, and the World Wrestling Council, which is Carlos Colon's promotion in Puerto Rico.
Yes, there were three Hercules.
The guy that got confused.
Was he also Hercules Cortez? Hercules Ayala?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it says ring names. Hercules Ayala, Hercules Cortez, Hercules okay. Ayala Cortez. There's another guy. There's another Hercules Cortez that competed in the AWA in the 50s and 60s.
That's this probably who. Yeah, that's yeah, probably who Trongard was, because he was an AWA guy. So I'm guessing that's who he kept mixing him up with.
After Gagne retiring in 1981, he focused the promo. Oh, that's the AWA promotion. Never mind. But yeah, so that's probably who it was.
All right. So and one of the things I actually wanted to mention in the commentary, this kind of takes Jesse out of his role because he's forced to do play-by-play here for the most part. So while he's still good, because Jesse's always good, you know, he's not up to his standard because he can't just sit there and riff on guys where he's going to kind of call the action.
He did a good job, though, working with if trying to keep Elvira entertained was not his – he pretty much had a babysitter.
Yeah.
I think Jesse and Lord Alfred probably would have been a decent team together.
I agree.
Because Gorilla, you know, because Lord Alfred was good at kind of analyzing holds and that kind of thing, and I think he would have helped Jesse along in that aspect. But the two of them had to babysit that other moron, so which is in essence what Gorilla and Mean Gene had to do with Kathy Lee is pretty much what Jesse and Lord Alfred had to do here, and that's pretty much make her say something silly so we can all giggle, and they'd be like, all right, whatever, and then move on to the match. So that's I think what the ultimate problem was here. But this match is just – it's very well done. Hercules is always a good worker. He wasn't as big, obviously, as he would end up being, you know, in the next 4 or 5 years. But it's Steamboat, man. I mean, Steamboat could wrestle, you know, a napkin and give it 2.5 stars. So good opener here for this part of the LA show.
And then we go down the tubes with our next match.
I hate this match.
I love this match.
hate this match. This is the Harry Bra match.
Yes.
Needed to wear them, Justin.
Please. How dare you diss Uncle Elmer like this?
Justin, I'll give you the honors. Go ahead.
And Matt's favorite, Uncle Elmer, who I despised all the freaking Hillbilly Brigade, as they face Adrian Adonis, who I don't think he was quite... was he the adorable Adrian Adonis? Yeah, I know he was... Okay, so he was past the biker gimmick now into the flamboyant homosexual gimmick.
Yes, he was pretty much... I even worded in our review. He is a fat Adrian Street.
Yes,
just,
basically.
And not even, but not as tough. Was just fat.
I hated all the hillbillies. Hillbilly Jim, I didn't mind. I hated Cousin Luke. I hated Cousin Junior. I hated Cousin whoever the fuck else was out there. I hated them all. Uncle Elmer. I just hated all their over the top mannerisms when they would. Oh, one time, the one thing that I hated the most was when they had that confrontation with Piper, Jesse, and Cowboy Bob on Saturday's Main Event. And they steal Jesse's hat and stomp on it. I'm like, oh, my God. It was like straight out of 1950s. It was just awful.
Yeah,
I don't know. I hate the fucking hillbillies. I can't stand them.
I love them all.
You would.
Okay, Elmer was a godsend.
Justin,
you just don't appreciate them.
just likes hillbillies about as much as I like midgets.
No, I don't like them either. I don't like short people or hicks.
They must have really hated WrestleMania 3 then.
Yeah, they were all teamed up. At least they got killed, all of them.
Yeah, well, at least one of them got squished. But yeah, this match is absolutely hideous. I mean, there's just so much jiggling going on in the ring. It's just terrible. I like the way you were.
Elmer is a pretty solid fat guy, so.
You actually call them the Hillbilly Brigade. I like that. I think that should have been their name.
Awful. Adonis, you know, he was a good worker in his day. And even at his elevated weight, you know, he was still pretty solid. He could bump all around, but, I mean, Uncle Elmer is just a terrible. I wish they lopped us 3 minutes off and gave it to Steamboat, or even the match that came after this one. Atrocious.
Yeah, and another thing that I concur with you about the Hillbillies, because I remember back then, Vince used to put them on TNT. Had to have been every week for about 5 months. Some god-awful, stupid skit where they're in a barn and they're dancing with pigs or some nonsense. It was so over the top. He was such on this hillbilly kick.
And they danced with pigs?
He did. They danced with pigs. And they always used to crap on Alfred's pants or some nonsense. It was just so bad. It was so bad.
I hate them. Let's move on. All right, our next match where things get a lot better.
Why did we invite you on this show? My God, you're going to give us an A+, aren't you?
No, I wasn't going to give an A+. The match was crap itself. I just love Uncle Elmer.
Awful.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the next one. Let's get back to the good wrestling.
All right, the next match here is our next to last match. It's the legendary Funk Brothers, Terry and Dory Jr., taking on Junkyard Dog and Tito Santana. As much as I wish Tito and Savage got their IC title rematch, can't complain too much because the match he was in was really good. The Funks, of course, were legendary, both former NWA World Champions. They show up here. Terry Funk actually got a pretty good run during 86, late 85, 86. Had a big title match with Hulk Hogan, Saturday's main event. But at this point, he just wasn't really made for the WWF style, or what they were looking to present as a product. So they don't last very long. But this match was good. You know, his only WrestleMania match until 1998. They deliver. I like this one. This was good. A good 11 minutes.
Yeah, I've always liked Terry Funk. But yeah, I agree with you. I think as much as both of them, and even Dory, who, you know, definitely was way past his, well, I don't say way past his prime, but he was definitely not in his NWA World Champion salad days. This was just a fun match. Funk, one thing I have to say about Terry Funk, Terry Funk always knew, and this would be prevalent with most NWA guys, because I'll say this in a couple years when we talk about the Brainbusters. Terry Funk was always good at like getting the chaos factor up in a match, because he's just so ridiculous, flailing his body around and taking beatings and just taking a beating and pumping the crowd up. And it was definitely a well put together match.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a great job. And JYD, you know, unfortunately JYD was starting to get a little plump here, and I think the coke was kind of kicking in here too. He was just glomming off the crowd at this point. And I hate to say that, cuz I love Junkyard Dog, and he does get a big moment the following year, but his ability in the ring just has gone downhill very, very quickly. And it's unfortunate. And Tito's Tito. He'll always show up for you. I've never had a problem with him in the ring in that aspect.
I agree with you guys on this match. I think it was a very good match. But the one thing I don't get about this match, and it's not even the wrestling part of it, is why the heck was Dory Funk named Hoss? Why did they decide to change his name? Was it to make him, to insult him or something? Why Terry Funk could keep his name and not Dory?
It must have been some kind. Maybe that was his nickname prior to that, so they just used it. Yeah, I don't get it. I don't think it was a disrespect thing, because I think the Funks, of all people, would have stood for it. They probably just would have walked out. So it had to be just, maybe it was just his nickname backstage, so they went with it, something like that. Or maybe they were playing up on Ponderosa. I don't know. Scott could tell more about Ponderosa.
I don't know what the deal was with that either. Ponderosa. I don't know what the deal was with that either. Because he comes back as Dory in, what Rumble was he in? 96 or 95? I think it was
96.
Yeah.
Yeah, 96. He comes back as Dory anyway, so. Yeah, I enjoyed this match a lot. Just the chaos factor and Dory just, you know, Terry running around like a nut job. And I definitely like this match a lot. Definitely highlight of the show. But I'm happy for the people in L.A. If I had bought the ticket in Nassau, I'd been really pissed off if these people in L.A. got, like, such a better card.
And before we do move on to the main event here, I just wanted to take a moment and do something we didn't do, which is run down the ridiculous amount of celebrities that were at this show. I have it pulled up here. In New York, various celebrities that were in attendance or took part in the show were Cab Calloway, who I believe he's a musician, right?
Yes, he was a trumpet player. Yes.
Daryl Dawkins, of course, Chuck Thunder, I think that was his nickname, he's an NBA star.
Yes. G.
Gordon Liddy, who...
He worked for the
CIA?
He worked for the FBI. He worked for the FBI, and he was in Richard Nixon's cabinet, and he was involved in the Watergate scandal.
He's a bald guy with a mustache that everyone knows, just from
his look. That does the gold. That ended up doing the gold commercials.
Joan Rivers, of course, was a longtime comedian, and now she's still a comedian and still ticking.
Except held together with clay and spit right now, the number of surgeries she's had.
And, of course, the boxing guys, Joe Frazier, Lou Duva, Ray Charles, who sang America the Beautiful before the show, and then Susan St. James and Herb, it says here. Who is Herb? Do we know who
Herb was? Herb was in the Burger King commercials.
That's right.
I don't remember why, but he was.
Okay.
Wasn't Donald Trump in the stands, too, if I remember correctly?
That was WrestleMania 4.
Oh, I could have sworn he was there.
You know what? It doesn't say it. He could have been maybe there, but it's not on the Wikipedia page here that I'm using. So then we go to Chicago, and it was Claire Peller, who was at the Who's the Beef? Or Where's the Beef lady, I believe?
She was the Where's the Beef lady in the Wendy's commercials.
And then you had all the football guys, Ozzy Osbourne, we mentioned, and Kathy Lee Crosby. And then in L.A., we had the great Ricky Schroeder from Silver Spoons in the house. Robert Conrad, Tommy Lasorda was there. I believe he was either the timekeeper or the ring announcer for the main event. Something along those lines.
Tommy Lasorda was the ring announcer, yeah.
Yes, and then Elvira. So that's a ridiculous amount of celebrities. Some B-level, some A-minus level.
Some Z-level.
Yes, I mean, yes.
Do we really need the friggin' people in the goddamn fast food commercials? I mean, come on. Herb? For God's sakes. I mean, that was terrible. I don't know what... Vince must have been drunk. I don't know. Maybe he was doing coke with Hogan in the friggin' limo.
In his mind, WrestleMania 1 was all about the celebrities, all about the stars, and I think he just, you know, wanted to keep that going, so he reached out to anyone that would show up just to, you know, just bring in as many possible stars as he could to overload the show. So, but with that, let's get to our main event. Was Hulk Hogan defending his world championship against King Kong Bundy inside a steel cage. We talked about Bundy a little bit last week in our WrestleMania 1 review, and you could tell, you know, the way he destroyed Special Delivery Jones, that they really were starting to prep him for a big-time run. And that big-time run began in February when Hogan was defending his title against Don Morocco. Heenan came in, distracted Hogan, and then King Kong Bundy came in to beat the crap out of Hogan with a couple avalanches and some splashes. Hogan got taken out, and he'd eventually show up with taped ribs to set this match up.
Yes, and that was actually pretty important because that was that same night, that same Saturday night's main event is when they debuted the Hulk Hogan Real American music video. It was the same night when he, you know, the playing the guitar and the, you know, the motorcycle and all the kids running up to him, and it was the same night. So it was actually a pretty impressive Saturday night's main event. A lot went on that show.
Yeah, definitely. And Bundy switched from Jimmy Hart to Bobby Heenan in September. So I like this match. I think, you know, solid match to cap off the show. Like we said, LA had a lot of good action. Nothing standout, but they had, you know, three solid matches out of four. I like this match. These two guys work hard. You know, the cage helped. The blood helped. It's only 10 minutes. They never slow down. I love when Hogan power slams him off the cage. To me, that's one of my favorite early WrestleMania spots. So good stuff all around here. I like this match. I think it's actually one of Hogan's, you know, better WrestleMania title defenses from like a in-ring standpoint.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people on paper look at this and go, oh, God, I mean, this was a mess. But really, it wasn't. And we had mentioned briefly in our WrestleMania 1 review that the rumors originally was that Vince was trying to get Nikita Koloff to come in from the NWA and face Hogan at WrestleMania, big, you know, USA-Russia thing. Mm-hmm. And but I think Nikita was primed for a big main event push in the NWA. I think he was set for a world title feud with Flair, so I don't think he was going to leave at that moment. And I think he thought that Vince was going to re-ask him again, and he never did.
Right.
So I think that was it for Nikita after that. But I thought Bundy was a fine choice, and I remember you telling me that you first really hated this match, and I remember we watched it not recently, but when we started, when we first got these reviews going, I remember you watched it and you liked it a lot more. And then you got me to like it a lot more when I watched it. I really think I agree with you. I think Hogan did a great job of putting Bundy over as a big heel in the beginning. I hated that cage. This is what started the
blue cage.
The blue barred cage, which I think that's because Vince was trying to kick back on the blood, although Bundy did bleed in this match.
Well, so. I think part of it too is it was actually I think the main reason was that it was more presentable for TV. The camera could get inside the bars, get better shots, and that's what they were all about at this point, was the TV production. So I think the fence cage, you know, they thought didn't really lend itself well to television. Because I think they still used a fence cage at some house shows around right. this time. So they kept this one for TV. And I never minded the blue bars, I think, because I grew up with it. I didn't really grow up with any kind of fence cage. So to me, this was always the WWF cage. So I was fine with it. But that's it. Hogan gets to win. Matt, you have anything to say about the main event before we wrap up this WrestleMania 2?
I disagree with you guys. King Kong Bundy at this point in his career was a little bit more mobile than he was about 10 years later when he faced The Undertaker.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was definitely a good match for Hogan and King Kong Bundy. And it really ended the night as good of a note as you could, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the show itself overall really is just a mess. I think it's officially the worst WrestleMania. I know there are others that people think were worse, but when you really break it down, this show had one great match, and even that was only in our scoring a 3.5 across the board. So to us, that's a very good match, and then a couple other solid matches, and then the rest was just trash. You have the Hollywood Squares arrangement of guests and celebrities. that's where most of them belong there instead of here. I just think they tried too hard to make this a mainstream, media-driven, celebrity-driven event. They kind of took a step back off of what should have been the focus, and it kind of just delivered a debacle. But at the time, I guess you can see what Vince was going for. It's hard to kill him because, at the time they had weekly or monthly cards in these arenas that were made up of similar matches, so this was their one chance to really go out and score, a big big showing across the board on closed circuit and some limited pay-per-view. So they brought in all these celebrities. It was their chance to be mainstream. I can't kill them for it, but looking back at it now, it's just, I don't know. I hate it. I think it's an awful show.
Well, I just don't know where Vince got the idea for half of these celebrities. Do we really need Herb from the Burger King commercials?
Yeah.
Was exactly. It really the best you could do?
No.
I mean, come on. That's awful. And Claire Peller? Good God. Guys like Tommy Lasorda, I don't mind, because you're in L.A., and the Dodgers were, they were having some good seasons in those mid-80s years. So being there was fine. It's kind of the same use that Billy Martin had doing the first WrestleMania. But, I don't know, I still don't understand where the hell he got the Herb and the Claire. Those two, I think, are the ones that pissed me off the most, Herb and Claire Peller. They didn't even do anything. And it's funny how he just would get three beautiful women, well, two beautiful women and Elvira, to be the ring announcers and or the commentators, and they were just so bad. He had to have known that they were going to take a beating. I mean, he put a lot of faith in Gorilla and Jesse to actually try and carry these teams, because it was just awful. It was awful. And I find it funny that Vince gave Gorilla Mean Gene, and he gave Jesse Lord Alfred, and he didn't give anybody for himself as a buffer. He got stuck trying to carry Susan St. James, and he wasn't even that good at the time. So. Yeah, I think that's another thing that kind of kills this show for me. The announced teams are just so bad. And thank God it didn't take away from a lot of the better matches, but the commentating just kind of totally destroys the show, in my opinion.
Matt, any final comments on the show?
You guys pretty much covered it all. WrestleMania was still in its early stages. They were trying to learn what was best to go with. Obviously, this was not anywhere close to being what it should be. But I think if it wasn't for this, we wouldn't get in what next year's WrestleMania was like.
Right.
So in a way, even though it was a crappy show, has really no reason for you to go watch it unless you really want to watch all the WrestleManias. It's not one you would go back, oh, I want to watch this one. But overall, it sucked.
Yeah, pretty good.
good way to wrap that show up. So that does it for WrestleMania 2. So, but before we close up here, we did want to take care of some bookkeeping work. If you want to visit us at our message board, of course, the place to be, you can visit us at bigelow34.proboards.com.
Oh, hey, do you want to read some things?
I'm getting there. Will you chill out? Will you chill out?
I just want to make sure. You're doing bookkeeping. I just want to make sure.
Shut up.
Fair enough.
Go back to
Uncle Elmer match, will you?
Go back to sleep, Matt. All right. So then you can also send us an email at placetobepodcast@gmail.com. You can send us an email there. We will read it, as we're about to do. You can also find us on Facebook. If you just type in Place to Be Podcast in the search button, it'll come up, and you can go ahead and like us, and you'll get updates. We we put comments or update anytime we're going to be having a new show or we've posted a new show. You can also comment on the wall. So right now, let's get into the little bit of feedback we've gotten so far from our buddy Rob Houston. First, he sent us a comment via our email to a post on the Podbean blog. Said he loved the first episode, and he's added it to his iPod for his daily workout. So I can attest to that, because Rob and I go to the same gym, and which he actually works at as well. And I saw him listening to the show, and he came up to me, and we talked about it. So that was pretty cool. He also posted on our Facebook wall regarding our last podcast, where we talked about The Rock returning on Raw last week. He said he thinks one of the great dirty promos is when Jericho comes out as his first run as Y2J, cuts his promo, only to be interrupted by The Rock, who rips him for 7 straight minutes, one of Rock's best moments on Raw. So that's some feedback from Rob. And as we said, any feedback you leave us on our email, on the board, on the Facebook page, we will read it on air. If you're interested in coming on as a guest, let us know. We'll have you on. We have some big podcast of those coming up later this week. Our friend Leanne Griffin's going to be on. We're going to talk about some Jersey Shore, talk about her blog, Fun with Carbs. And also later this week, we're going to wrap up the first half of the NBA season. Matt will be back with us, as long as our buddy Andrew Ritchie, who's a big NBA fan as well. So we're going to get him on. We're going to talk about that. And so that's what's coming up. That's some bookkeeping there. So you guys have anything to say before we wrap things up?
It's been a great show. Again, hop on the email, hop on the Facebook page, let us know what you think, and we'd love to hear your feedback. And we'll read your stuff on the air. And who knows, maybe we'll do a contest, and you can actually co-host a podcast with us.
Yes.
So
definitely. So to play us out here, Scott has queued up the number one song in the country the week of WrestleMania 2, the week of April 7th. We've confirmed it's a Monday. So that week in 1986, we're going to go ahead and play the number one song in the country. So for our buddy Matt Rotello, who's off to bed, and Scott Griscolo, this is Justin Rosero, Place to Be Nation. We will catch you later this week. Hit us with your feedback, and we will talk to you soon. Thanks.